What does the owl wear a mask?
Yes, this is Precognitive Dissonance, live on Anomaly Radio.
On Thursday, November 29th,
dude, woohoo!
Yeah, almost December.
Man, sorry it's been so long, folks, but you know, it's the holiday season, so you gotta do what you gotta do.
And, you know, this ain't our day job.
Not yet.
Still a... Whoa, yes. I've never felt more like a DJ, Miles. I am what I play. Easily one of my least favorite Bowie songs, but, you know, that's just me. Yes, indeedy, it's Precognitive Dissonance, and show we have for you tonight.
We got lots of UFO stuff. We got brain scans to talk about. We got more UFO stuff. We got... consciousness,
yeah.
Weirdness,
the
school
running meme,
freakiness,
the running meme of hoaxes, and what they mean. But kick out the jams, Miles.
Go for the bubbleheads.
This is why the owl wears a mask.
All right, everybody. So, yes, it's another Thursday night with Precognitive Dissonance live from Austin, Texas. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks for sticking with us. You can always listen to the past episodes of the show over at precognitivedissonance.com. And you can always shoot us an email. You can get me at music@anomalyradio.com, as well as web@elphus.net. And gosh, if you search enough, you'll find other ways of contacting me online. So,
he's everywhere.
Yeah, we got some new announcements about some new websites and new enterprises going on here locally that I'm involved with, but we'll save that for later. Man. So, yeah, that song you're hearing, that was my good friend's Pong. Pong. They former members of a band called Ed Hall that was one of my all-time favorite bands of all time, of ever, forever.
Awfully neat, too.
It's inspired by the Frostbank Tower downtown.
Yeah.
The owl. Austin's own nose-trimmer insectoid owl building downtown. One of two owls dominating the landscape in the Austin.
Interesting. I've never really looked at it as an owl before. It's more of a Crystal Palace Kryptonian kind of structure to me.
Yes, like crystals from some Superman planet that's Kryptonian.
There you are. Or the monolith monsters, you know. which, if you haven't seen it, and I mean Miles and you, our listeners, the Monolith Monsters, late 50s, one of the best and oddest science fiction monster films to come out of that hazy decade. That's all.
Ah. So, man, UFOs on the brain... In the membrane.
And you brought up the Bowen manuscript post by Nick Redfern at UFO Mystic, which, if memory serves me, ties into the Majestic 12 documents and a few other things.
The Bowen manuscript, as far as I know, is simply significant for its being AWOL for the last several decades. A person named Vernon Bowen, a writer of books for children and a successful advertising copywriter, according to UFO Mystic, died at the age of 78, and between 57 and 61, he worked on his flying saucer manuscript, which he gleefully, graciously sent to the Air Force, to make sure it was accurate, and then it vanished. And it's only just been returned, sorry for the lip smacking, folks. However, in 1999, a strange thing happened. The same original typed version of the manuscript that Bowen sent to the Air Force all those years before turned up in the mailbox of none other than UFO researcher Timothy Cooper. Now, Timothy Cooper was basically, I believe, the fellow on the Brits' side of the pond who received supposed MJ-12, Majestic 12, UFO government documents. But here is a case of where this manuscript that's been missing, that's seemingly likely been in the hands of some, you know, either traditional government military intelligence outfit or perhaps some extra rogue UFO group like the Majestic 12 for decades.
In a warehouse in the hands of top men, Miles.
And it's now been returned to the man who, on the British side of the pond, publicized the uncertainly known Majestic 12's documents, the documents that were not, that, you know, some people go back and forth about. That's their whole thing in ufology. Mm-hmm. For some folks is this paper trail. And as I've always said to Stanton Freeman, don't these guys have paper shredders? I mean, I know, hey, we work in a bureaucracy. There is paperwork, but not always. And if you don't want it around, it's easy enough to get rid of. Anyway, this is a really interesting
development.
If you
happen to think about it.
This is a real interesting development, and that apparently some of the pages have been stamped top secret magic, M-A-J-I-C.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it's yet another thing for people to endlessly debate.
Which is, you know, kind of weird. I mean, it's a children's book. You know, it's a kid's primer of UFOs.
Is it? It said that he was an author of children's books, but that doesn't necessarily mean that.
And
that
Encyclopedia
was...
Flying Saucers to me says, you know, well, and that's...
okay. So Jerome Clark is a children's book writer.
Okay, well, we can look at the PDF of the original manuscript and judge for ourselves.
Oh, is that so?
Yeah.
Oh, this is at the bottom of UFOmystic.com under mm-hmm. the Redfern Files
article called "The Bowen Manuscript."
This also brings up the issue, and you can find out more about these documents and the other Majestic documents at, guess where, majesticdocuments.com. There's, oh, crap. There was this.
You're all over the place.
This article actually spurred Greg to write about another interesting document that's known as the, I lost the page. I'm so ashamed. Oh, wait, there it is again. M.K. Jessop, Paranoia and the Case for the UFO. M.K. Jessop was an infamous character supposedly silenced by the original report of Men in Black and the UFO lore, and he later committed suicide, or did he? And a copy of his book was sent to the Department of the Navy, and it had been annotated in three different forms of ink, by allegedly three different people, giving alleged gypsies with an intense interest and apparent knowledge in all things ufological, making commentaries about the fact that humans had perfected anti-gravity a long time ago, and it almost intimates the idea of ultra-terrestrials in some ways, or the idea that there's some human group on the planet that has anti-gravity UFOs. But here at the Anomaly Archives, we actually have a reprint of this. It's spiral-bound. And the weird thing about this was that it was the Navy reprinted the book with the annotations, and they contracted a Texas-based publishing company called the Varro Company, V-A-R-O, and it's known as the Varro Edition. Very strange stuff.
Very limited edition, 25 copies. You know, it was all obviously intended to be distributed to a fairly small group of people. But it's interesting. I mean, there doesn't seem to have been a tremendous amount of secrecy surrounding it.
No.
And
in fact, the intro to this edition is got two ONR officers quoted as saying, "Because of the importance which we attach to the possibility of discovering clues to the nature of gravity, no possible item, however disreputable from the point of view of classical science, should be overlooked." this actually is going to a lot of these articles are going to dovetail nicely together tonight. I was supposed to give a decent length lecture the other night at a public library on UFOs opposite my friend and compatriot Mike DeGroff, who's the head of the Austin MUFON group. You can find out more about them and their monthly meetings at austinmufon.org. We were giving a presentation on Ufology 101, and his part of the presentation was slideshows of UFOs and art and literature, you know, cave paintings to classical art to modern and not so modern photography. And I was going to do a little thing on crypto ufology, the secret or hidden side or the less talked about side, the more interesting things to me. And among them were a little known article by a fellow who contributed to a really great book of collected essays called UFOs and Abductions. And in it, he argues that science may not be the best school of thought or system to grapple with the UFO. He goes into the possibilities that the legal system, but even better, military intelligence may be the best. And we can go into that later, but that's going to dovetail with a couple of other things that we're going to talk about tonight that are UFO related. But yeah, you can find out more about the Varro edition of the classic The Case for the UFO by M.K. Jessup over at UFOmystic.com. And one of the things that this dovetails with, among others, is Stanton Friedman's new book or documentary.
It's a book.
Coming out next year.
Next March, I think. March or May.
And you said you had mentioned this before we got on the show, or?
Yeah, it looks like an interesting read. Nick lays out basically an overview of the contents. And it sounds like essentially Friedman's manifesto, if you will. Comments on the blog, I was moved to comment because Friedman's one of those people that I have a lot of respect for him. I know he's been powerfully active in the field for a very long time. I don't think he's made a lot of the cases that he asserts, and you know, I've always been very skeptical about the Majestic documents, which I know he championed for a very long time. But
again, paper shredders, man.
But like I say, the outline of this book, he's a very firm believer in the extraterrestrial hypothesis. And, you know, I go along with the notion that there is certainly some evidence that some UFO reports have an extraterrestrial origin.
It's a possibility.
And I also think that a lot of UFO reports have a potentially ultra-terrestrial explanation. Yeah. I can't exclusively subscribe to a single theory of what UFOs are, other than, you know, a definite social phenomena. You cannot make the statement that UFOs do not exist.
Absolutely, yeah. It's, I mean,
you'd be wrong.
You'd be wrong. I mean, it's absolutely, you know, perfectly logical that there will be things that remain unidentified, period. And also, but it has to also be maintained that as much as we might talk about hyperdimensional or ultra-terrestrial or psychedelic UFOs or the aspects of mythology and psychic phenomena that are part of this phenomenon as well, that these are very real things, that they affect the local environment in ways that can leave permanent indelible marks for a long, long time. Friedman's one of those that I respect him. I respect him a lot, but at the same time, yeah, I haven't been interested in most of what he's had to say for a long time. The person who drew out something that I have not seen yet, but I'd like to, which is Friedman's lecture that he gave at the Halifax Frontiers Conference that Paul Kimball put on up in, I think, Halifax, Nova Scotia. they had him, instead of giving his normal shtick, the, you know, cosmic cover-up of UFOs, it was him as a nuclear physicist talking about the science and technology of inherent in the descriptions of UFO reports. And I think that's, you know, yeah, get back to his element. Talk about that for a change. another thing I know we wanted to talk about, and I think I have, yeah, various places, the article at UFO Paradigm about Nazi flying saucers.
Interestingly titled, For Whom the Bell Tolls.
Because of Joseph Farrell's book.
I'm drawing a blank.
Oh, okay. I thought you... I'm sorry. Joseph Farrell...
I know he's mentioned in the course of this article, but...
I can't remember the title of the book, but it's something like the Nazi Bell. It's all about the Kecksburg object shape being part of Nazi research, which is actually mentioned in this article. So, I know you and I have talked about Nazi flying saucer ideas a lot over the years. And,
well, you know, it don't take me much to get wound up.
So,
but yeah, this looks like an awfully interesting new blog series. It's part one of at least two parts. There are some new names mentioned in it. There are some old chestnuts dragged out. He makes the comparison of the actual artist's impression that the famous photograph of Kenneth Arnold holding it up after the 1947 sightings.
And drawing the parallel to this other bomber.
This is the night fighter form. The blogger describes it as the Nazi Horton V4. It is not, well, it is only one of those things. It's actually the V or Versuchs 8 or 9 of the Horton or Gotha 229. One of the last jet fighter prototypes that the Germans managed to get off the ground before the end of the war. What you see in the blog is an artist's impression of the two-seat radar-equipped night and all-weather fighter version.
Juxtaposed to the famous black-and-white photograph of Kenneth Arnold pointing to an artist's rendering of a boomerang-shaped, delta-shaped wing object that... Really, and you know, with right next to this one is definitely suggestive. I mean, there's obvious differences, but it's an interesting comparison. One of the things that I like about this article is the way it starts off. This article, by the way, is over at paradigmprobe.blogspot.com, which is, of course, the new interesting UFO blog, the UFO Paradigm Probe. And the article is part one, For Whom the Bell Tolls, as Craig said. But he starts off by referencing the photograph that leads the article, and he's got some rather parapolitically speculative and conspiratorial language there that I appreciate, and that is, I often wonder who won World War II, especially when one considers the Nazi nightmare and how successfully the technocrats of that regime skillfully hid and readapted their viral technocratic skills to a variety of high-level posts, as Kurt Waldheim, pictured above, did so admirably. As Secretary General of the United Nations. It's one of those little known things that I think most people haven't a clue that a former Nazi headed the United Nations.
The fact that it came out was what led to his resignation and disgrace.
And he was very good friends with Arnold, Mr. The Governator.
Schwarzenegger, who made some... Not exactly pro-Hitler statements in his youth. It was interesting. It was an interview in a men's magazine, one of the lower rivals to Playboy in the 70s when he was making his name as a bodybuilder, especially in the documentary Pumping Iron.
Yeah.
But he was basically... expressing a certain measure of admiration or wonder at Hitler's abilities as an orator.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of stories about
Arnold. Arnold as a young man evidently was, what you would expect a big piece of beefcake to be.
Well, it's interesting that he would lead off this article in talking about the Nazis with Waldheim, because Waldheim, not just head of the Secretary of the United Nations, but in that capacity did something kind of interesting to ufologists. And I believe I've read of his and Hynek and Valet's interactions with Waldheim when they were petitioning the United Nations to perhaps act, since U.S. governments and other scientists weren't. And I've wanted to play this before. We've talked about this disc, and I know I'm jumping wildly around, but we'll get back to this article in just a second here. But from J. Allen Hynek Presents UFO Encounters, a double disc classic that features cases from the subject's foremost expert. This has got audio samples from everybody, from Hynek and Stringfield and Leo Sprinkle, and some original interviews with cops and city officials and abductees and close encounter witnesses. But the whole thing ends with Friedman, Hynek, David Saunders, and Valet giving their conclusions about UFOs and theories. But there's also an extra special person on the end of this. Take a listen.
In fact, it is now widely accepted that the universe may well be teeming with life.
The National Aeronautics and Space Administration has shown great reluctance to enter the arena of UFO investigating. And yet, ironically, NASA saw fit to include an unusual and significant recording aboard the Voyager 1 and 2 exploratory probes on their intergalactic missions to Jupiter, Saturn, and beyond. The introduction to the two-hour recording is by Kurt Waldheim.
As the Secretary General of the United Nations, an organization of 147 member states who represent almost all of the human inhabitants of the planet Earth, I send greetings on behalf of the people of our planet. We step out of our solar system into the universe seeking only peace and friendship, to teach if we are called upon, to be taught if we are fortunate. We know full well that our planet and all its inhabitants are but a small part of this immense universe that surrounds us, and it is with humility and hope that we take this step.
And there's where it ends abruptly. I don't know if there's actually more from that. You can actually hear the clicks and pops on that recording, so it may be that somehow the vinyl ran out. I don't know, but it's interesting. It's just interesting hearing this guy's voice, but the article goes on to talk in very general terms, setting up this series of articles that he's doing, listing a lot of the people, the names that come up over and over again in different circles related to the idea that the Nazis may have had some advanced flying technology.
There's a photograph of a fellow pen poised over a piece of paper described as Nobel Prize-winning gravitational science, Dr. Walter Gerlach, who I have to admit I was unfamiliar with before, who was a major contributor to the Nazi creation of this odd and enigmatic experimentation, and who, according to some, was frightened or coerced into silence and abruptly abandoned his life's work after the war and for all purposes and consciously sank into obscurity.
Yeah, the grammar in this article is very bad.
I think I am recalling who this fellow is now. I wasn't aware he remained in Germany during war, but some equations that proved something in either special or general relativity, but supposed to have some particular implications. He was supposed to be working on some others, but for some reason, generally cited to be psychological. There was some kind of falling out. This is really irritating. I
On the tip of his brain, he's reaching up his nose.
I am not. The persistent rumor that all but a few of the scientists involved with this experiment were purposely assassinated by the SS, with the exception of Dr. Gerlach and a few others.
Yeah, I know.
One reconsiders the odd coincidental rash of deaths experienced by a fairly substantial group of British researchers associated with the space defense strategy.
Yeah, this is the infamous Star Wars scientist deaths that occurred back in the late 80s, early 90s. And which
it's another one I'm unfamiliar with.
It's been a while, it's interesting, and both of these things have the kind of the air of the alternative three, you know, people being silenced or disappearing who might be in the know about certain programs.
Yeah.
But the article goes on to talk about a lot of things, and of course it has to mention the obligatory operation or paperclip, the importation of Nazi scientists. But it also mentions the interesting book, The Hunt for Zero Point, by none other than Nick Cook of Jane's Defense Weekly. I believe he's a managing editor or one of the technical tech science writers.
And that's the Kecksburg UFO monument, right?
Yes. And this gets back to what we started this rant
about. Which isn't credited as such. There's a reference to the book The Hunt for Zero Point by Nick Cook, which brings us back, I'm quoting again, which brings us back to that concrete henge which may or may not have some relation to the Kecksburg incident. What we're referring to as an odd ceramic bell that is a casing for a hybrid centrifuge of sorts, powered by an enormous quantity of electrical voltages, supposedly capable of creating, among other things, its own gravity field, as well as an enormous potential as a weapons platform for plasma weaponry.
At the beginning of the article, he reproduces these photographs of what I believe are one or more strange facilities that the Nazis were using for weird experiments. One looks like a concrete Stonehenge. Another is an underground photograph of a mine shaft that may have to do, maybe this is the V2 manufacturing
it's
place.
It's probably, one of the V2 assembly facilities. Also, it also looks like...
it's got eyes, it's looking at me.
Well, the Germans were building a lot of underground facilities for aircraft and rocketry manufacturing in the closing year of the war. Yeah.
Later in the article, he goes on to mention some of the other people that apparently play a role in the emerging story that he's going to be documenting soon. Again, this is over at paradigmprobe.blogspot.com, part one, For Whom the Bell Tolls. And some of the other people he mentions, some of these I've never heard of. Others I'm like, oh, okay, I recognize the reference, the context. But let's see. Among the people he's going to research, Arthur Rudolph, chief operations director at Nordhausen, where 20,000 slave laborers died producing V2 missiles. Kurt DeBus, rocket launch specialist, another SS officer. His report stated he should be interned as a menace to the security of the Allied forces. Huberto Struggled, later called the father of space medicine, designed NASA's onboard life support system. Struggled is a name that's in, I don't know if it's replete throughout the X-Files mythos, but in a mystery audio track on the end of the X-Files album where Chris Carter reads a very telling fictional story element, he mentions a Nazi named Struggled. Interesting. Among the other people, let's see. Well, again, draws the parallel between the 1944 German design of a aircraft, not German Nazi aircraft, that was given to Northrop Aviation, who later produced the B-2 stealth bomber, and drawing those parallels. Now, who is this person? At the very end, he says, and most importantly, we will take a very close look at this gentleman. DeBus. Okay, this is the fellow he mentioned earlier, I guess. Kurt DeBus? It's
One
letter difference. D E B U S.
Now, where are you seeing the caption to it?
The JPEG is named D U B U S Z.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Interesting stuff there. Looking forward to what this guy's got to say about the Nazi saucer menace.
This looks interesting. Yes, I did see that.
Which, I wanted to just quickly say, of course, our good friend Nick Redfern, who will be back soon telling us about the UFO crash retrieval conference that's put on by the Woods, who are into the Majestic 12 documents. He's got yet another blog, saucerspies.blogspot.com. That's saucerspies, SPIES.blogspot.com. And the official blog of Nick Redfern's book, On the Trail of the Saucer Spies, which reveals the startling story of how and why government agencies secretly spy on the UFO research community. So he's off to a great start. He's got some interesting stuff on George King, the Aetherius Society, and the British Police Force's special branch. The Aetherius Society is one of those rather interesting and entertaining UFO saucer cults. It's the British equivalent of the California Unarius Society.
Mm-hmm.
I say equivalent just in terms of equal kookiness. Maybe less kooky. I don't think they have crystal flying spaceship recreations and rituals where they charge.
They got a rhinestone-encrusted Cadillac and a fat chick who dresses in silk with a tiara like 3 feet tall.
I don't think so, but...
Well, I'm not sure the other guys do either, but, you know.
I just wanted to comment briefly on this other article. Alien Orb Examined My Baby Girl, and there was nothing I could do.
Kathy Porter at LostCon 34 book signing. Lenny standing in front of a poster
of her book.
Book cover, Gray/Guardians by Kathy Porter. Earth is in trouble.
Now, I don't really have much to comment on this other than I was unaware of this author, and it's always interesting to see an article about, you know, somebody who is incorporating these themes into their work because, they had an experience.
Mm-hmm.
And as the article begins, Kathy Porter woke up to see an alien orb hovering near her baby daughter's crib, whereupon the horrified mom rolled over and went back to sleep, because a mysterious force prevented her from protecting her baby girl. That's the chilling true-life tale that this mom-turned-author told the Weekly Universe on November 23rd at LostCon 34, Los Angeles' premier science fiction convention. Her tale of terror occurred 17 years ago in Los Alamitos, California. Porter was asleep in bed, her hubby by her side, her baby daughter peaceful in her crib. The thing that interested me was this description of a ball of light that enters the room through the wall and exhibits what is interpreted as intelligent movements, and also it seems to create or be associated with paralysis of eyewitnesses, and or in this case, I think paralysis and also the making her go back to sleep. Now, again, the people who are familiar with sleep paralysis and the hypnopompic and hypnagogic experiences, the realms that you pass to on the way to and from sleep, have some similar symptomologies. Balls of light not always being one of the more common ones.
Yeah, well, it's not entirely clear if it's a ball of light or if it's a ball emitting light. She describes it a little further down the page here as the orb was a metallic blue and emitted a light whirring sound and a bluish red whitish glow that vibrated about the orb. Until she looked at it. As long as I'm looking at it, the light remains steady, as if it was observing me while I was observing them. That makes it sound almost like she's watching, you know, a literal physical presence, not just seeing a light.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm.
Well, felt sensed presence is another part of that type of sleep paralysis. Interestingly, it also says that it's a tale of seismic activities, a pandemic of seas, severe environmental allergy syndrome, orbs, and alien abduction. That's really interesting. I actually may want to get this because, of course, anybody familiar with UFOs and alien abductions has probably heard of the tectonic strain theory And the idea that seismic activity could create electromagnetic effects that could affect human consciousness in ways that create these kinds of things. Severe environmental allergy syndrome. That's an area I'm not familiar with this particular acronym, but the basic idea is something that I'm quite familiar with. And in fact, one of my favorite UFO abduction books is called, in Britain, Allergies and Aliens: The Electromagnetic Indictment. And in the United States, it was published as Psychic UFOs, and this is by an author named Albert Budden, B-U-D-D-E-N, and he's got a lot of amazing data that you can find in the electrophysiology literature about electromagnetic effects on not only consciousness, but the human body, and how these electromagnetic fields that the body emits and that it interacts with or in the environment around you can interface and affect each other.
And, well, there, it's not exactly a punchline, but I feel compelled to point out this line in the final paragraph, but this alien confrontation inspired Porter to write the sci-fi novel,
yeah.
Grey Guardians. Its first chapter is based on her true life experience. The rest is wholly fictional. So C's may be an acronym that she came up with herself.
Yeah. Hitman. So. It's a pretty good one, actually. You can find out more about this over at weeklyuniverse.com. Alien orb, examine my baby girl.
Not the Weekly World, but...
the Weekly World News. But.
They're trying. And God bless Fortean Times for including a two-page spread on the demise of the Weekly World News.
Yeah, so. God bless them, everyone.
Well, yeah, in a broad, general, non-specific God sort of sense, okay?
All right, so there's so
I
much
I just thought
more
it
to
was an awfully nice thing to do. Indeed, flying wings again.
Okay, so,
this time?
I don't know where to jump around. I do want to mention, we mentioned earlier that the Nazi UFO article over at Paradigm Probe, another interesting article I haven't had the chance to read in depth, but that intrigues me, is called Is There Synchronicity Afoot in UFO Flaps? One of the best shortest UFO books I've ever read is called The Archetype Experience, and it's all about Jungian psychology and synchronicity and archetypes being a key element in what determines whether somebody has a significant UFO encounter versus just a distance sighting of a light in the sky. But I want to turn to some other areas, including... the Paradigm Research Group released a press release on November 26th. Re 1993 to 1996, Rockefeller Initiative to End the Government-Imposed UFO ET Truth Embargo. Hmm. PRG publishes to the Internet documents from the Office of Science and Technology Policy, OSTP, during the Clinton administration confirming the Rockefeller Initiative. And basically what this was is Lawrence Rockefeller was trying to persuade President Bill Clinton to release public government documents held on UFO phenomena. Now, a lot of documents did come out under the Clinton administration related to the Kennedy assassination and the mind control, electromagnetics, and radiation research. A lot of the stuff that the real heinous use of heinous use of EMFs as well as just traditional radiation. Used on servicemen's wives, some of whom were pregnant, all that kind of stuff came out under the Clinton administration. But this goes on to say, Rockefeller's move to effect disclosure lasted from March 1993 through 96. Researchers aware of this effort commonly refer to it as the Rockefeller Initiative. While the initiative itself was not successful, it did lead to engagement of the UFO ET issue by Associate Attorney General Webster Hubbell, Congressman Stephen Schiff, John Podesta, Governor Bill Richardson, and others right up until the present time. Haven't had the chance to really investigate this and look at the documents yet, but this is interesting. Leave it to a Canadian. Canadian UFO researcher Grant Cameron, who was denied entrance to the U.S. on his way to a UFO conference in the last couple of years, probably because of his focus on politicians and UFOs, perhaps. He apparently did a FOIA, Freedom of Information Act, and got these documents from the OS, UTP. You can find out more about this at mediaforfreedom.com. And, of course, the links to all the articles we're talking about tonight will be over at Precognitive Dissonance.
I wonder if they're hiring. I would love to influence science and technology policy in this country.
I know you would.
We need a death ray, Mr. President. A great
they're already
big
working on that.
Death ray. No, 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 no.
They've got pain ray. They've got the pain rays.
Yes, well.
And soon they'll be zapping you from above with the drones that they're going to be using. This is really interesting stuff. This past week, Houston's local 2 news apparently did a pretty good investigative journalism piece, or was it a PSYOP? I'm not sure, but Local 2 investigates captures secret HPD test on tape. Basically, the Houston police, along with the Department of Homeland Security, were testing a remotely piloted vehicle to be used by the Houston Police Department. Well, we don't know for exactly what, because, well, this is all secret. And apparently the only reason the public found out about this is because the local news managed to get video footage of it, and they tracked the RPV with their helicopter for over an hour. Supposedly the DHS people coordinating this event for the HPD folks threatened the helicopter, saying that they had instituted a no-fly zone over the test area, the demo area. The FAA was contacted, allegedly, by Local 2. They said that the FAA told them, no, there's no such no-fly zone. You're perfectly legally in your right to be observing this. And then within hours, the police chief held a press conference that was unscheduled to talk about this because this news story was airing or was about to air.
Yeah, there's nothing. You can watch the video at anomalytelevision.com.
We can link over
on
to
Parapolitical Friday, I think.
Yeah, this, yep. The headline is Houston Police to Get Ticketing Drones in 2008, which is, of course, a speculative headline because at this point they're mostly talking about using it for surveillance, but it's been suggested that they could be used to you know, for speeding, catching speeders or whatever. Within a few days or within a week of this, two other really interesting articles have come up, and that is that Florida police are now looking into using unmanned aerial vehicles and remotely piloted vehicles for similar types of law enforcement. And a French company has said that they're going to be marketing next year a drone that can actually tase people from the air. And this conjures up the images from They Live. And it reminds me, I've never seen this videotape, but a few years ago, shortly after 9/11, there were stories circulating about a video that was being shown to people that basically invoked two very strange bedfellows, a national ID card and retinal scanning police drones. The video allegedly showed a saucer-shaped drone flying through the sky that then swoops down and basically barks at a person, you know, demanding their identification or demanding they, like, stand still as their national ID card is read or some such. I've yet to ever see this. It's never surfaced. But if you know where that video is, please drop me a line at web@elphys.net.
Trippy.
Yeah, no shit.
Trippy. Well, it's, you know, kind of keeping with our theme tonight because we've got another flying wing type aircraft. Nothing in the image to give it any kind of scale. I don't really know how big the darn thing is.
Oh, yeah, it's one of these. It's about it's no more than like 6 feet across. It's pretty small. But it's supposedly got can carry a payload up to 15 pounds to carry the kind of cameras that could very easily track individuals and vehicles and see in people's houses, supposedly.
Well, it makes more sense as a traffic observation dome since it's not designed to hover.
Right. That one. The ones that they were showing off in Florida apparently are more like boxy looking.
Okay.
I don't have that link up right now, but back on the area of astronomy, This is kind of an interesting one. Sun's wayward twin discovered. This is from Yahoo News, news.yahoo.com. Somewhere out there, astronomers knew the sun had another long-lost relative aimlessly drifting through the Milky Way. Now they've found it. Although a happy reunion is unlikely, as the star HIP 56948 is about 200 light-years away, it is now considered to be the best solar twin out of four known candidates. This is kind of interesting. The discovery was made via the... astronomers Jorge Melendez of the Australian National University and Ivan Ramirez of the University of Texas at Austin, woohoo, discovered the new star with a telescope at the McDonald Observatory in Texas. Mid-sized star is one of many in the Draco, the Dragon constellation, and may be a billion years older than the sun, which is middle-aged at 4.6 billion years.
Okay. I'm beginning to grok the article. When I first read it, it was kind of like, damn, that should have been bigger news, shouldn't it? Because I thought they were talking about Nemesis.
A la Zechariah Sitchin and Ancient Astronaut Theories.
Mm-hmm. the notion has been, well, it was kind of on the fringes of astronomy for a long time. I think it's now been more or less conclusively disproven. But there was a notion afoot in astronomy for a while that... the sun, we might actually be part of a binary star system, and that somewhere out past Pluto was, you know, a brown dwarf or what's called a super Jovian, either a very, very small star that had not quite taken off, or a very, very large gas planet.
A gassy jovial planet?
Yeah. But no, this is about finding literally a twin to our sun. The implications for, you know, the possibility of solar systems like our own, is now a little bit higher.
So we'll be meeting some ETs any day now, yeah? And they'll be draconians?
I'm looking. Well, Zoltan!
Is that a secret society symbol you just flashed at me? No, it's the Zoltan symbol.
You keep flashing past that.
No, I'll get to it eventually.
All right.
We always love talking about craziness at schools. Mm-hmm. I do it. I keep bringing it up. Mysterious rash put school in lockdown. Yes, everything's about imprisoning our children. Yes, lockdown because there might be a madman in the neighborhood. Lockdown because there's a break-in at the local gun store. Lockdown because somebody's got a rash.
A suspicious rash, Miles.
Queensland. This is out of the Australian news.com.au website. A Queensland school was placed in lockdown today after a number of students developed a suspicious rash and were treated in hospital.
Number being three.
Another 69 students were isolated amid fears they may have been exposed to a dangerous substance.
However, a QFRS spokeswoman this afternoon said scientific testers had not identified any dangerous substances at the school. We haven't found any substances which could have caused these reactions, she said. She said QFRS officers would be in contact with the school in case further incidents arose.
Oh, man.
And they decontaminated 13 students.
Within the school grounds, and more than 70 students have been given an information bracelet with an emergency contact number to assist family and medical staff if a student has a reaction within the next 48 hours. Oh, man. So schools are now breeding grounds for mass hysteria. I guess they always were.
Now, yeah, you know. And this is one of those, I wonder if anybody's done any research in the newspaper archives here in the UK, Australia, New Zealand, to see if similar cases have cropped up. I mean, it's the sort of thing that, you know, might not necessarily have made the wire services, but yeah, there's an awful lot of local newspapers out there. You know.
It's a big world out there.
Yeah, big scary world.
I wanted to at least quickly touch on a really interesting article over at publicparapsychology.blogspot.com. It's Language and Anomalous Experiences, Dr. Robin Woofit. Back in September of 2007, an issue of British Journal of Social Psychology, a paper reporting findings from a conventional analytic study of an experimenter participant interactions in parapsychology experiments, was presented by Dr. Robin Woofit, a senior lecturer in the sociology department at the University of York. In the paper, Dr. Woofit discusses how the ways in which experimenters acknowledge participants' utterances may be significant for the trajectory of an experimental session. But apparently this research was taken upon by BPS Research Digest, and they suggested that Dr. Woofit had uncovered a flaw in this type of experiment, an experiment involving the Ganzfeld technique, where they basically put half ping pong balls over your eyes, sometimes with a backlight, so that you get a uniform, non-sensory experience, a kind of a sensory deprivation effect that is often used in these ESP, parapsychological anomalous cognition experiments. But several blogs, including Mind Hacks, Science and Consciousness Review, and others, were basically saying that reproduced this BPS research digest miss-summary, and the doctor contacted them, and they retracted it because he basically said that, no, you've completely misrepresented and misunderstood my work. And they retracted it, and they published his letter where he explains more specifically what his research was showing. And it's a fascinating read. It's very detailed. You know, if you're really into parapsychology from an intelligent scientific perspective, I highly recommend this article. So I just wanted to at least touch on that. Also, I wanted to touch on earlier, we mentioned Paul Kimball of Canada. I was talking about his Halifax, Nova Scotia conference. And he's getting some kudos for a science fiction play that he's doing up there.
Doing Time, which I was reading about earlier today on his The Other Side of Truth blog.
Redstarfilms.blogspot.com.
Is going to be on hiatus until the early part of 2008.
Yeah, he's working on a lot of different projects, including this play.
But, yeah, I saw this. It sounds like an interesting piece of work. It's a three-person show. It's playing in Oklahoma?
Oh, no. It's playing in Canada, in Halifax, Nova Scotia, Paul Kimball is based out of. But it's based on the short story by a good friend of ours, Mac Tonies, who's a blogger over at posthumanblues.blogspot.com. He's based in Kansas City, Missouri.
Ah, okay.
That's where he wrote the short story for an anthology called Illumined Black. And it's just really cool. I don't know much about the play, but I just am really excited by the idea of somebody who, like Kimball, who has an interest in UFOs, who's done conferences on the frontiers of science and ufology and cryptozoology and other interesting anomalous areas, that he would also be involved so interestingly in the theater and be taking those themes and running with them. So that's over at hfxnews.ca, Halifax, the Daily News, and it's in the entertainment section, sci-fi play Probes, Alien Intelligence. Gosh, we're running out of time here, and there were so many other things. This is a weird one. Flaws in Brain Explain Pedophilia. We were talking about this before we went on air. Man, it's basically saying that they did some studies.
Back to Canada. Scientists in Canada used magnetic resonance imaging and sophisticated computer analysis of the results to show that the pedophiles had significantly less of a brain tissue called white matter than the other criminals. This was a study in which the brains of convicted child sex abusers were scanned and compared with criminals who are not sex offenders, has revealed striking differences that could point to a neurological origin for pedophilia. The comments to this were kind of interesting. All of them essentially said the doctor's confusing correlation with causality. And as you rightly pointed out when we were discussing this, well, you know, simply because causality is not demonstrated doesn't mean that the correlation is significant.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
It's certainly pointing in a direction for further research. But yeah, I don't. This and other similar things, I think, shouldn't be jumped upon as a way of, oh, we can now prevent this, or you know, we can, you know, when we detect people at an early age with this imbalance of white matter in their brain, we can isolate them and try to give them mandatory, you know, anti-pedophilia workshops or something. That's the kind of thing that these kinds of researchers often want to jump onto immediately. And I was linking it to something I started hearing about in 1999, which is the use of MRI. I don't think it requires an MRI. Maybe it does, but it's the Farwell. I think it's the Farwell brainwave research that has used. Maybe it's just EEGs, the classic, just the little pasties on your scalp that send the electrical signals that can tell what type of brain state you're in. But obviously MRI would be able to do it even better. But it's basically a neurological lie detecting technique where they show you something that hypothetically if you've seen it before, your brain will react in such a way as to demonstrate that it recognizes the images. Whereas if you've never seen the image that they're showing you before, the brain will react in a different way. So basically, this could be a neurological polygraph or lie detector where, you know, they might show a series of suspects evidence from the crime scene that no one else has seen except for the investigators and the killer. Mm-hmm. And whoever's brain reacts to it in the way that demonstrates hypothetical seen it before. Now, I was also mentioning how back in 2000 or 1999...
Oh, okay. Yeah, basically the scan would detect those areas of the brain that sort of memory is stored in.
Right.
You know, and register that activity. Ah, okay.
And as far back as 99 or 2000, I was thinking about this and how it could be used to test the reality, perhaps, or certain aspects of UFO and abduction cases. Mm-hmm. But in fact, Whitley Strieber, at his presentation at the Texas Book Festival back in 2000, in the midst of the clamor outside the state capitol and the governor's mansion, where crowds of protesters because of the standoff between Gore and Bush over the selection, and it was quite rancorous to be hearing Strieber talking about, yes, we could apply this technique to abductees and help determine the physical reality of the some of these phenomena. And I was like, wow, that's intriguing. Nothing's come of it, unfortunately. But we've run out of time, folks.
Damn all.
I wanted to talk about some other stuff, but before we fade out here, I wanted to mention that I've started a new magazine. Some friends
Anomaly,
of mine.
Anomaly
magazine. You can go to anomalymagazine.com or austinanomaly.com. And there you'll see the first three articles of a new online and soon-to-be offline print publication here in Austin and around the globe, Anomaly Magazine. It's going to be featuring all kinds of subject matter that you hear on these and other shows here on Anomaly Radio. That is paranormal and parapolitical discussions about all things strange, weird, and important. And this is going to feature articles by folks like Mac White, myself, and Tom White, and others. And I don't know what you're pointing to. Well, we can't really read more right now.
I can.
Okay, well, thanks for listening, everybody. This has been Precognitive Dissonance.
With your hosts, Miles Lewis.
And Craig York. Thanks for listening.
See you next week.